shouts of space.
Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome to another episode of Seek Ye Out of the Best Podcasts. Today, we'll be diving into the world of parenting. We'll be trying to figure out how we keep up with the scriptures, how we keep up with the neighbors, and how we keep up with social science research. We can't do it all, but I've recruited a panel of rock star parents, even superstar parents. With their wisdom and expertise, we find some ways to help us better navigate the waters of parenting. And with that, on to the show.
All right. I have a panel of experienced parents with different skills that they've acquired along the way. And today we're excited to talk about a couple different TED Talks and podcasts that talk about parenting. We are going to cover parenting taboos, parenting now versus 50 years ago, and how that's a little bit different, and some of the things that we can either involve our children in or teach them, and what effect that might have, whether it's a ballet class or just wrestling and having fun, and how that may affect our children's development into healthy adults. So to start off, we have Natasha Helfer Parker with us, sort of the podcast rock star of the online Mormon world. Natasha, could you take a second and introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, I've never been called a rock star before, though. That's pretty cool. Those were dreams of bygone years. Anyway, I'm a marriage and family therapist. I'm also a certified sex therapist. I run the Mormon blog called The Mormon Therapist and host a lot of the podcasts on Mormon mental health. So just involved in a lot of different directions and excited to be here today.
All right. Dave and Vilo Westwood are here with us as well. Could you introduce yourselves and maybe tell us a little bit about your family and maybe some of your professional expertise that has helped you at least observe more in children and parenting?
I'm Vilo Westwood, and my husband Dave and I have 5 children who are all grown now. And I also have worked for many years in and around teaching. Right now, I am an outreach worker with Hispanic and other low-income families, helping them get their children ready for preschool. So I'm always reading and learning more about parenting to share with the families that I serve.
I came from a fairly large and mixed or mixed-up family, I guess one could say. And I'm also an educator. I've worked with children. My primary experience has been middle grades up, but I have also worked in pre-K to 6th grade schools quite a bit, and a lot of hands-on practice with our own 5 children, and I am the oldest of 4 siblings. My wife is the oldest of 7.
All right, well, that sounds great. I've been really excited about this. I've found the information in the podcast and the TED Talks really thought-provoking, and I'm also excited to have the experience and the expertise that you bring. So let's jump right in. The first TED Talk was one on parenting taboos, and I found it quite entertaining, and they go through 4 parenting taboos that apparently we're not supposed to talk about. The 4 taboos are: first, you can't say that you did not fall in love with your child in the first minute of life. Number 2, you, new mothers generally, can't talk about the loneliness that you feel once you have a baby. And 3, you can't talk about your miscarriage, and I appended to that in Mormonism, you can't really talk about infertility. And both of those are really important things to talk about, in my opinion. And 4, you can't talk about getting less happy after having kids. We always like to talk about how great our kids are and how they're the love of our lives. But I think in reality, we're limited in what we can do once we have small children, and they are not always bundles of joy. At least that's been my experience. Maybe I'm the only one. So let's talk through some of those real quick. What did you think about the first one? Where did you feel when you started having children that you could not say that you absolutely fell in love with your child in the first minute of life? Or maybe you lived that. What was your experience?
I think for me, Bilo Westwood is the oldest of seven children and lots of family and neighbors with big families, that I had managed expectations that I knew it would be tough and lonely in many ways. I did have good support. My mother had also, I don't know how, communicated to me that it might be a good idea to have a stack of mysteries by my side so that I didn't just concentrate on the baby and any wild emotions I was having.
So did you say you had a stock of mysteries, like mystery novels, or what was
yes.
that?
They're great for when you're breastfeeding and you've just stared into that baby's eyes all you can manage.
That's probably really good advice to be able to focus on something else. Natasha or Dave, did you have that sort of false idea that you have to, that you do fall in love with the child in the first minute of life, or maybe you had that experience?
Well, I think talking about it from a more general aspect of just kind of within Mormon culture, which is I think what we're trying to address here today versus, I think these are taboos, obviously, in general culture as well. But I think one of the things that come up for Mormons in particular that I think make these taboos even more difficult is that so much of our seen value as members of our Mormon society is that of being a parent. Especially, I think the role of mother is very much idolized and looked forward to, or at least set up to be this pretty amazing thing that, you know, as a young woman, you're constantly reminded of and kind of propelled towards by, you know, well-meaning leaders and parents and all kinds of, you know, just kind of our society in general. And so we do build it up a lot that this is a woman's, you know, major calling in life is to become a mother. And therefore all of these kind of accolades are given to different aspects of parenting and motherhood. So I think what these taboos are trying to address is that by doing that, we're not always telling the whole story. And therefore people can be wildly disappointed or let down when things don't necessarily live up to the expectations that they had thought they would. And I think one of the things that she said just before is that she had been given somewhat realistic expectations, so that was helpful for her, but not everybody is. And so when you don't necessarily have that amazing bonding moment, or when you have a pregnancy that's extremely difficult, or when you have a birthing process that is extremely difficult and not able to have maybe those bonding moments that you first thought you'd have with a newborn, or when things get stressful and you're bogged down with, you know, very monotonous work, you know, which is childcare, which involves a lot of dirt and poop and throw up and not very, you know, wonderful things, then all of a sudden those can be pretty rude awakenings. And it can be difficult from the kind of idealistic picture that we set it up on Sundays to look like.
Yeah, this is Dave. I would say from my perspective as a father, when my children were first born, I bonded, I was overwhelmed. It was beautiful, miracle of birth, wonderful, but I fall out of love intermittently over the years. And I was a difficult child myself, and I have fairly keen memories of the mixed messages from my various caregivers, parents, and other relatives who made it pretty clear that I was not always likable.
I can't imagine that.
We haven't met in person yet, Brian.
I've I've gleaned a little bit from online. You have a fun personality, if we could say that. I think what they're trying to get at, I think Natasha got to this, is telling more of the full story. At one point, they said that their goal with, I think they were launching a website or something, their goal was to be brutally honest. And it kind of caught me, like, if all that you talk about is the bad things, if all you talk about is the poop, for instance, but being brutally honest means telling the good stuff as well. And so I think, Natasha, you pointed to this, that we don't want to just tell the happy things. We need to tell the full story. I mean, I know my own wife at times has felt like she wasn't cut out to be a mother because she was bogged down in, while I was in grad school and away quite a bit, she was bogged down with the hard parts of being a mother and having kids scream at you all day long. And she wasn't enjoying having children scream at her all day long. And so she started to have feelings like maybe she wasn't cut out to be a mother. And I don't know anybody that really likes to have small children scream at them all day. I think that's a normal thing. And it would be good if we could normalize some of that. So what do you have any ideas or suggestions on how we can facilitate more of an honest discussion around what being a parent really amounts to?
Well, I do try to do what others did for me and set the expectations with humor and tell some fun parts, but also I give mystery books to new moms at baby showers. Along with their cute toy for the baby or whatever. Oh, actually, I give books for the baby too. But so I, on a person-to-person basis, I do try to do what was done for me in sharing all aspects of mothering, and that we're all different. And some parts, I tend to prefer children when they can talk, but babyhood is a stage to get there.
I think that's a great idea to add more. I mean, you give gifts at showers like diapers or cute clothing and stuff, but that's all for the baby generally. It would be good to give things that are just for the mother and not necessarily another book to tell her how to be a mother, but something that she might enjoy on her own. I think that's a great idea. One other thing that I experienced when I was in grad school in Iowa, we had a married university ward. So everybody with kids, three and under, or if they were married and a student there, they went to this ward. And so you had an abnormally high concentration of pregnant women in the ward. And for those women that were not able to have children, it was actually really hard for them to be at church and to hear these stories and to see all these other women that are able to get pregnant and have children. And so there was a I believe it was a blog that was formed and sort of this closed group where they could meet together and talk about the frustrations and the hard parts of not being able to have children. And so I think in some ways the online media, and as well as having a good leader maybe within the ward to facilitate that sort of need, is a way that we can help each other do a little better than we have in the past.
I think that's good. I do know several people that have struggled with it in our ward have been pretty open about it, and others have tried to be supportive. But having a group with everybody being able to say what they want on that topic and know the others will understand sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and I would add to all of that. I mean, I think a big answer to probably almost any problem is education, right? And so I think that's what we're getting at. And there's lots of different ways we could address this. I mean, one is obviously person to person, like, you know, Philo giving a certain gift at a baby shower that implies certain things, that is, you know, talking about really the self-care of the mother. There's more organized ways that we can do it, like giving workshops or classes or firesides or whatever, you know, types of more organized ways. There's obviously the classes that are given with church curriculum, you know, like the parenting classes and the marriage classes that are already part of ward experiences, but maybe adding some, you know, more specific information to those classes that's applicable to each ward and the needs of each ward. You know, some wards are generally young or have a lot of children in them. There may be college wards or just certain geographical places, and others maybe don't have those needs as much. But I think some of the topics that I would hope would be addressed is kind of some of the gender roles that we, you know, we expect mothers to be naturally nurturing. And I get this a lot from women that feel like they fall short of that. Like there's something wrong with me, you know, kind of like to your point about your wife saying, maybe I'm not cut out for this. You know, if the kid is screaming and there's three things, you know, on the floor and by things, I mean bad things like poop and throw up at the same time. I don't mean three toys.
I was going to say, that's a pretty clean house if there's only three toys on the floor.
I'm like imagining a floor of mine at one point that had three really bad things all at the same time, like spilled milk, food. Anyway, and you know, and you're feeling like, oh, a nurturing, you know, how we define those words, like a nurturing woman would just smile and, you know, just kind of roll her eyes and laugh and think this is just fine. You know, most of us don't do that. Most of us are pretty frenzied by that point. And it's not really natural for anybody to be that nurturing, you know, in that sense. But so I think we built up this expectation of what these definitions are. And so anyway, just kind of knowing your traits, knowing your gendered roles, that just because you're a woman, that doesn't necessarily make you more nurturing than your husband. I mean, we all come with different traits and strengths and weaknesses, and kind of talk with one another about what you think those are. Like, what do you bring to the table that maybe the other person doesn't? I know, like, one way that I thought through things, you know, with myself was, as you get to know other moms, you see all the different things that like 30 of your friends are doing, and you compare your things to those 30 other things, right? And so it's like, well, I don't do that, and I don't do that, and, you know, but I lose sight of me, what I'm doing. And so I just decided, okay, I'm a good reading mom, and I'm a good travel mom. I am not a good sit down on the floor and play mom, and I am not a good cook mom. And, you know, so, you know, just kind of like accepting what I was not probably ever going to be good at or had no interest to be good at, and then enjoying those things that I was good at and that I really, you know, bonded with my kids over, instead of trying to be good at it all, which was not working for me, was, you know, causing clinical depression. So that's one thing to think about. I think that being aware of the research is important. I mean, we do know that stay-at-home moms are more prone for depression. We do know that postpartum depression is a very important thing to be aware of and be thinking about and talking about and looking for red flags on. We also know that even if you don't have all of the diagnostic criteria for postpartum depression, that doesn't mean that you aren't going through some pretty significant fluctuations after having a baby. It takes about 2 years for you to recover from having a baby. And so, you know, just kind of being aware of those kinds of things. And then I think the last thing I was going to say, too, is to be aware of this word happy. I mean, you talked about you can't talk about getting less happy after having kids. Like, that was one of the taboos. But happy is a complicated term. And I actually prefer the verb or the word content. Because I think there are times every day where I'm happy and every day where I'm frustrated and even angry and tired or elated. I mean, like every day I can have like, you know, 20 different emotions at any given time. But in general, you know, am I content? Whereas when we put the word happy, I think that that's a cultural term right now. I think not just in Mormonism, but in the entire United States, that has a lot of baggage attached to it. Like every day I'm just supposed to be happy. And I don't know that any of us are that. But I think having kids does take a huge amount of sacrifice and time and money and energy and fatigue. And therefore that's going to inflict on our quote unquote happiness. And at the same time, there are those moments of true joy with your kids. And most of us who've had kids wouldn't trade them. Wouldn't trade that experience. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that it's completely correlated to happy, happy, happy.
I agree. I think happiness is oversold. And I think both marriage, before having children and raising children, we somewhat over-romanticize in our culture, the culture in general and Mormon culture perhaps in particular. And that I don't know that one has to be brutally honest to be candid, but if we can learn to accept that there are highs and lows. I like the notion of community and sharing. I'm having these experiences without necessarily dwelling on just the negative. I've found in many areas, you can just find other people and say, I'm having these feelings. When you know other people are feeling them as well, it lightens the load and reduces the stigma.
Absolutely. And happiness is a loaded word. I love the thing in the first Parenting 101 where she talks about, or one of them, where she talks about maybe instead of saying we want our kids to be happy, we want them to be productive. There's other words we can use, and I think that goes for us as well. Are we doing something meaningful that we feel is very important? As far as a mother being endlessly patient, something I've shared with a lot of mothers is Dr. Haim Ganot, the child psychologist, said you should only act just slightly nicer than you feel. Otherwise, it's very confusing for the child. So losing your temper may be an appropriate response to some situations.
We also have generally told our children that the reason they have two parents is it's very rare that both parents will want to kill them at the same time.
One will step in to protect.
I've been in those situations where my wife has protected the children from me and vice versa. I think that's pretty,
you know, there are times
that's pretty true.
When one of us is frustrated and the other is, I have a genetic investment, or I really like that, appreciate that. There's been times it's like, the fact that this child is irritating you is important to me.
I think you hit on some really good points, especially I hadn't realized it until you said it, but happiness is like this really popular word right now. There's a lot of books that are coming out left and right from positive psychology about how to be happy. There's a documentary/movie called Happy, and it's sort of this elusive space or this elusive state that it's really hard to access. And I think it's a moment by moment thing, like you've described. And the whole premise of the second talk that Vilo has led us to is that everybody at one point says, all I want for my children is to be happy. And we're not so concerned about them being really wealthy or being really smart or, you know, I mean, we want them to have their needs met. We want them to be intelligent. But it's, I don't know, this, it just always comes around, all I want for my children is to be happy. But if this is a ephemeral state of mind or state of being, that's not a very good goal, because we're only going to hit it a fraction of the time. So then, how do we engender work ethic, decency, and love in our children, where if we have productive kids and moral kids, they're likely going to live a life that gives them a fair amount of happiness?
Yeah, and I really liked these thoughts that Jennifer Senior talked about, that if we teach them how to, for instance, you know, do service or be kind, it's like in those moments they are also reaching happiness. But we're not measuring just that. You know, I mean, it's like, for example, like if you tap me on the shoulder in the middle of me yelling at one of my kids and ask me if I was happy, I'd be like, hell no. But if you at the same time tap me and interrupted me in that moment and say, are you generally content in your life? Then I'd say, yeah, I think so. Even though I was angry in that very moment. Do you see the difference?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and so that's kind of, I guess, what I'm getting at, and I think what Jennifer Senior is getting at is that, of course, we want what's best for our children. I think that's generally true of most parents, and we want their success, we want them to move forward. But, you know, part of, I think, even the whole Mormon journey is very interesting in the sense of understanding that, and it's not just Mormon, it's most other religions have this understanding that pain and hardship and struggle is part of the human journey, and we're not going to be able to avoid that for our children. We're not going to be able to keep them from those other emotions. And therefore, it's more about what I really want is to be able to engender resilience, you know, or to engender this sense of safety that, you know, even if those things happen or when they happen, there's still a sense that there's a place I can go, or there's a place I can process, or there's people who will support and help my pain, even though it really hurts right now. So I think that's a better way to frame that than just say, oh, I just want my children to be happy. It can be kind of, even though I understand the sentiment, it's somewhat superficial to just speak of it in those terms.
Yeah, I view it as naive and overly optimistic. It's interesting that Natasha brings that up, because I had just opened a window on resilience. I work in many schools, and there's a new emphasis on social emotional learning and trying to teach children to be resilient. And I feel like as parents, that's something I wanted to focus on, and I think we did. And I'm hoping that our children, as they have children, will pass that on and focus on resilience. You have to deal with the dirty diapers, the vomiting, the disease, the accidents, the pain, the mishaps. But overall, one can find contentment and fulfillment as well in the way we interact with each other.
I do think that Mormon culture has a few things to offer on this road to resilience, and that is scriptural and family history examples of people who have gone through great adversity and have managed to keep going and ultimately find contentment, we'll say, but they got through their trial and felt that it was worthwhile. So I think comparatively, we may have a real richness of stories of people who have made it through difficult times that others may not have as readily at hand.
And I would totally agree with Viola on that. I think we have great strengths and stories to share, and just like anything, we also have great weaknesses. And I would say one of our biggest weaknesses in Mormon culture around this issue is that of expectations. I think we're very equational in our approaches. You know, if you stay chaste, if you marry in the temple, if you go on a mission, if you do this or that, you will reap the rewards. And many times those rewards are fertility or marriage, or, you know, happily forever after. I mean, that's what we think those rewards mean. And so I can't tell you how many times I am sitting in front of couples or individuals, you know, saying things like, but I did everything right, and yet we're getting a divorce. Or I did everything right, and we can't have a baby, you know, or I did everything right, and I'm depressed, even though, you know, it's what I wanted. I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, and now I can't even get myself out of bed. So it's kind of furthering the discussion that, yes, there do come. I mean, obviously there are risks that you avoid if you stay sexually chaste, you know, or there are things that you will gain from going on a mission, or there's a commitment level from marrying in the temple that's beautiful and can really help, you know, any spousal team, you know, kind of frame their life together in really helpful ways. But those things do not guarantee anything. They do not guarantee anything. And I think as Mormons, we forget, you know, the story of Job or the story of many wonderful scriptures where people who've been good and righteous suffer things that don't seem fair, or that they didn't ask for, or that are not having to do anything with punishment or things of that nature that a lot of times people assume.
Yeah, it's really interesting that we have these paradigms that if we follow, we're supposed to get this certain reward. And Jennifer Senior points out that the paradigms are all but gone now, that for having a family, raising children, because in the past, she said the kids with their free time, they would either be working in a factory and hopefully not losing their limbs, or they would be working on the farm, or they'd be working around the house. There wasn't all this free time. And so as we've quote unquote progressed, we have a lot more free time. And so now we have soccer moms, and we have kids running to do all these different things that are either just to kill their time, or hopefully to help them have an edge in school, or help them gain friends or have a social experience, but it feels like there's not this solid paradigm anymore, and so it's kind of you get into the parenting world and you almost don't know what to do because there's so much advice out there. And I mean, one thing, my daughter went to a ballet class this last spring, and it was like once a week for a half hour, and there were other mothers that were there that spent 4 to 5 hours at this ballet school because they would do the hip hop class, and then they would do the jazz class, and then they would do the ballet. And we had a neighbor that was putting their 3-year-old into all these different extracurricular activities. And, you know, it almost feels like we're grasping at straws trying to find out what we can do with their time and what, you know, what we can train them in earlier than before so they can get on the path even faster. So, I mean, to me as a parent, I'm like overwhelmed trying to figure out, well, what do I do? And so do you see that as different from when you were raising your children or starting out?
Well, we went to a parenting class when the kids were fairly young with a curriculum by Dr. Stephen Glenn. And he said that people back in the time you were mentioning, where you worked on the farm or you were in the factory, had many inner resources, such as patience, hard work, being able to delay gratification, all these things, but they had very few opportunities for education or advancement or whatever. Now children many times have myriads of opportunities around them, but they haven't developed any inner resources. The patience, that thing. I would include with those inner resources a passion for something, an interest in something. And so for what Dave and I did with our children, was we nurtured and encouraged passions they expressed. We never signed them up for anything that they were not interested in, other than I probably had everyone take music for at least a little bit to find out if they liked it. But mostly we followed their lead in what do you want to do. And there's one of our children that did a lot less of all that sort of thing than anyone else, because what he liked to do was sit around and think. That was pretty good.
Yeah, there's an interesting, I think, study there's a lot of studies around this kind of stuff, but this idea that kids on tight schedules are less able to self-direct. So in other words, their lives are being directed for them, right? There's a very, you know, they're going to school and then they come home and there's this lesson or that lesson or, you know, sports. And of course, we have a lot of church activities as well and scouting, et cetera, et cetera. So, and you know, I have 4 children myself, and my rule has always been 1 activity per kid. But even with that rule and church, we're really busy. You know, we're going places all the time, even though they only have 1 activity per kid. But and a lot of times other kids have to go along and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of carting around that I think people, even who really try to structure or have less things going on, are still dealing with in our current American culture anyway. But the study showed, and I thought it was interesting, that when you have kids kind of being more free to decide how they're going to entertain themselves, then that correlates to being able to be more directive and therefore being like maybe leadership skills or however you want to directiveness. But, and this is kind of the classic, like, I don't know how many people have anxiety when one of your kids comes up and says they're bored, right? And I'm like, how can you be bored when we have, you know, like lots of things that I can think of anyway right now that you could be doing. And usually I'm bored means I want to go play video games. But anyway, so these are, I think, struggles that all of us as parents have. And I do think that there's an interesting correlation between the idea that, you know, back in the times that you're speaking of, kids were more of an asset in the sense that you needed kids to work your farm, right? Or you needed kids to help you survive and do all the work that needed to be done in order to kind of manage as a family unit. And then that's really shifted to now kids are a liability. And in the sense that, you know, you're going to be spending a lot of your own time and energy and money making sure your kids are in a position to be able to succeed or at least have a leg up, which is, I think, what we're all, at least in middle class America, trying to frantically outdo each other because if, you know, Jenny across the street started taking ballet when she was 2 and she has any natural talent or passion for it, then my 15-year-old who wants to start taking ballet and has natural talent and passion for it is probably never going to catch up, right? And so that's the reality that we're facing in this world where, you know, we can see American Idol, and So You Think You Can Dance, and these kids just go on there and make it look like anybody can do anything. And although that's a nice thing for us to think, and I don't want to stomp on anybody's dreams, the reality is that a very low percentage of people get to that type of level of fame or success in mostly any field. Like, most of us do mediocre at something and do okay, you know, but we're not prodigies or, you know, having Olympic medals or things of that nature. Most of us don't get to that level. So that's even a difficult complexity, right? Like, are we lying? I heard one of these other TED Talks talk about, are we lying to our kids when we tell them they can do anything or achieve anything? So that was an interesting perspective on that. Anyway, I don't know that I'm getting any great answers, but I think that this balance between free time and structured time is important to look at as parents and continually be addressing and understanding what's, you know, where are we at? Are we do, you know, where can we do best so that everybody in the system is thriving, not just the kids. If you've got kids who are doing 500 things, but the mother is now clinically depressed, or the father is like going through anxiety attacks because he can't pay for all the lessons or whatever it is, that also correlates to the kids, right? I mean, depression and anxiety and all these other things that parents can have going on, it's not like the kids don't notice those things.
And I think we need to be conscious about having the children have meaningful roles within the family so that it's not unbalanced, that the parents aren't doing everything for the children. And that takes some creativity now that it's not automatic.
I'm old enough, I was not allowed to be bored, because if I pointed out that I was bored, I was given a list of chores. And most of them were not things I really wanted to do if I could avoid them.
And we did tell our children that boredom was a sign that they didn't have sufficient creativity. So we'd hear them sort of bite the word off in the middle and say, no, no, I am not bored. I'm going to go find something to do because I am creative.
Yeah, those are two great strategies. I love both of those.
That's good stuff. This is actually really interesting. I'm learning a lot myself from you guys being on here. This is great. I want to go through the Economist Guide to Parenting from the Freakonomics podcast, where it seems like they were trying to get at how much is nature, how much is nurture, as far as the how our children end up, and what sort of things seem to be effective. And they talked about this accidental experiment called the Holt adoptions. I believe it was this family, the Holts, were adopting all these children, and they would then place them into different foster homes, and it was a first-come, first-serve basis, so the all the children were distributed somewhat randomly to different families, so there wasn't socioeconomic divides necessarily. And so that way they could look at two twins that have the same genetic makeup, four identical twins, and put them in very different environments by accident, and then see what happened. And it seems out of this study they were able to find that, for instance, in education, parents that, in comparison to the highly educated families that the children were put in, to the low-educated families, the highly educated families increased the likelihood of the child attending college by 16%. So that seemed like a pretty a positive result. But when compared to another control group of some sort where the biological parents had very high education, that the increase of or the likelihood of the child attending college was increased by 75%. And so it's the ability of someone to learn, it seems like, is something that we're endowed with from birth, that's in our genes, and if we're given the opportunity, then we can excel at it. And parents also seem to have a very moderate effect on the future of income of the child, so the wealth gaining ability through the 20s, but then later in life there seem to be no effect. And so we kind of give our kids that stuff when they're born. But the interesting part I found was that there are the more important things than gaining wealth or gaining education, such as the children learning to be good people, learning to be kind. Those things seem to be to have a strong correlation with the parents, and so that they actually could, whether a parent was, I think it was smoking or drinking alcohol, or the way they treated different people, that seemed to be imprinted on the children quite well. And the other thing they pointed out, we've kind of talked about, is that the obsessive parenting was more likely to make parents unhappy, and the most important factor in parenting is being a happy parent, or you could say being a non-depressed parent. And so sometimes making up long lists of things for our children to do, just to use up all the time and feel like we're keeping up with the neighbors that have put their kids into five different summer activities, it's not necessarily going to do us any good, because it's just going to make it harder to live, it's going to make it harder to parent, and it's going to bring us all down instead of doing what we wanted it to do, which is to make everyone feel better. And I think that plays right along with what your experience, the experience that you've shared with us. But one question I had in there is that it said one of these economists claimed that electronic entertainment, and I hear this from my three-year-old all the time, that he wants to watch a show or he wants to play on the Kindle or whatever, that electronic entertainment is not a negative thing, and that if you need to have your own personal time, go ahead and turn on the TV or let them play their game or whatever, and that's fine. But I had heard since we started having children that too much time watching TV, too much screen time, as they call it, can lead to autism or can lead to negative behavior. In your experience as educators and as a therapist, is this guy off his rocker, or is this like a cultural myth that TV and game playing has a negative impact?
I got a few things that I'll say, and then I'd like to hear from the others as well. I don't know that we have any true knowledge of what causes autism. I think there's a lot of speculation and studies and even possible correlations, but I don't know that we have what we could say a full-fledged, absolutely, this is what causes autism. So I just want to put that out right up front. And I think that, like most things with parenting, there's usually really good research on both sides of the equation. I think that there are concerns about too much electronic time. You know, like, for example, when you get research that maybe people are spending 5 to 6 hours a day in front of electronics, maybe that's too much. At the same time, we live in an electronic age, and the fact is that part of, I think, building resilient kids that can function well in the future is going to be learning how to balance electronics as part of your life. It's just, it is. It's part of our life. It's part of work opportunities. It's part of how we gain information and data. It's part of research. You know, it's just going to be, it's a new age that we're in. And a lot of these studies, I'm sure, will be replicated over the many years to come, and hopefully we'll learn more about how it's affecting us. I mean, we do know a few things, like if you're in front of a screen, you know, after a certain amount of time at night, it's harder to fall asleep, right? So, I mean, we do know some of these things, but in general, is it awful? I don't know that I would agree with that, but is it something like most things in life that we need to balance? Yes, probably. And then the other part of your question, now I forgot, so I'll probably just let them go ahead and then I'll gather my thoughts.
Well, I do believe in moderation in all things. I work with autistic kids, some of whom have never had screens in their life. So I don't think that is at all an issue. It is how it fits into the fabric of your life. A once in a while thing, a treat, great. If it's 6 hours a day, obviously not great. Also, screen time that is with a parent or that the parent passes through, sees a little of what's happening and has a conversation with the child about later, can be quite good. You can actually, like with Sesame Street, if a parent talks about what's going on in Sesame Street with a child, they found that the child learns about 3 times as much as they would sitting there by themselves. So screen time, and imagine a kid playing a video game with a parent and laughing and cuddling and whatever. But sometimes you do want them to just do it by themselves. So there's a lot of different things on that. I think one thing that is, I think the playtime and having a lot of family fun time, a family is really a laboratory where you can learn to get along with a lot of different people, because there's a lot of different people in a family, even if it's just a husband and wife. And the one thing that we haven't mentioned yet that I think is really important too is it's a lot easier to get kids who are moral and decent and fun if you have parents who are clear about what they stand for and what is interesting in their life, and have enough balance to know how to have fun and how to work hard. So some of that work we need to get ourselves centered, and it will be a lot easier to share that with our children.
Amen. A couple of things. I tend to be very eclectic in my views, and I'm a strong believer in moderation and diversity. In education, there are a lot of battles, whole language, phonics, different approaches to mathematics. I get, in my career occupation, I wind up getting stuck between people with very strong views about one model or school of thought or another. And I think I frustrate all of them because I say some of each. As Natasha and Vilo have said, moderation, a little variety, is a good thing. We all need water, but if we have an environment that's 100% water, we drown. I like
that.
There's a quote I love about models. Essentially, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And with parenting, there are a lot of different models, and many are useful in different contexts, I feel.
Yeah, and now I remember going back to your first thoughts about nature and nurture, and this is like the old debate in psychology, and I think that the sooner we understand that nature and nurture are intertwined in ways that we don't even, I think, quite grasp, is really important, because it really plays into these concepts of agency too that are so important in Mormonism, why I think we have a hard time understanding addicts or addiction, because we're like, well, but you can choose not to do that. And so that's a lack of understanding of how genetics and biology play a role in limiting agency in ways that we don't always understand. And unfortunately leave people within our membership feeling very marginalized. Same with, issues of sexuality or issues of, there's issues also with race and different cultures, that different cultural or ethnic backgrounds that you come from have different traits associated to them that may play a really big role in things that we think are choices, but maybe aren't quite so clear cut. And neuroscience is just really kind of just stomping through a lot of the assumptions we've made over the years of human psychology. And a lot of the research that's coming out is just so interesting. We think we're in so much control over our lives, and we're starting to find out maybe not as much as we think or would like to think. So how does that play into, our Mormon views of agency and God-given brain where we can make our own decisions, when maybe some of these decisions are already imprinted on us, if for lack of a better word. And yet there is the other part of it as well, where we do know that we do have influence. We do know that parents who smoke have a higher likelihood of their kids smoking. Same with alcohol, same with eating habits. You know, a lot of these things are intergenerational, and so we definitely know that the nurture part plays a role as well. And this is also good in a lot of ways because kids do listen to their parents. We think we lose, I'm sorry?
Influence.
We think we lose influence. And we might for a while, you know, while they're testing and kind of trying to develop outside of the parental realm, which is a developmentally appropriate for them to do. But in the end, kids are more often going to be able to listen to their parents' messages than to others. And so we do have a lot of influence as parents. So it is, it's kind of a mess of of concepts that, you know, how much influence am I having? How much influence am I not having? And this is why I think we would all just really benefit from taking a Valium and watching a TV show, you know, like you're saying, as far as, you know, like worrying about where, how our kids are going to turn out. Like so much of how, I mean, yes, do the best job you can, but at the end of the day, you can't go back and revisit every single mistake you made as a parent just because your child is acting or behaving or choosing something that you don't agree with or don't see as valuable, right? I mean, they have their own journeys too. And I love the book called Scream Free Parenting. It's written by an MFT. I forget his name, but he talks a lot about how a lot of the issues in parenting is just figuring out our own anxieties. You know, what as our kids are acting and behaving and doing their thing, what anxieties come up for us? And how does that inform our parenting approach? And I just think that's a really good way to look at it because at the end of the day, they're going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah, that it's really interesting how you mentioned neuroscience and how it's changing the way we understand things. One thing I didn't include it, but there was a Radiolab episode that alerted me to something really interesting, where they were studying these rats and. This gets to the nature-nurture thing. They were studying these rats, and they had some rat mothers that would lick the rat pups and when they would get stressed out, and that was kind of like us hugging our child when they cry, and it would soothe them. Then there were other mothers that wouldn't do this. And they found that the nurturing had a strong effect even down on their what's referred to as an epigenetic level, so very, very deep into the nature of these rat pups. And so I imagine we have similar things going on as a child is developing. There are times where they just need to be held and they need to feel safe, and that can be protective of them. Another thing, and I think the last one, the On Being podcast, was all about play. Which I found really interesting because it talks about how things that seem like they're not very useful or not very productive are actually very, very important and fundamental to our own development, and that would be play. I like the definition that he gave at one point where play is anything that is spontaneous, done for its own sake, appears purposeless, produces pleasure and joy, and leads one to the next stage of mastery. And, you know, they talked about all kinds of stuff in there where children who are roughhousing and fight, it looks like they're fighting each other, they're actually developing empathy. And it just made me think there's so many things where if you have to kind of stand back and let the kids do their thing and let them go a little crazy, let them do their games with their friends where they argue a little bit and maybe they run off crying. We've had that with our daughter where they – her and her best friend kind of break each other's heart a couple times a week, and then they get back together and they have fun. What I'm thinking is they're actually realizing how to negotiate, and they're learning and developing and figuring out how to interact with other people rather than not learning that and becoming antisocial and then having a lot more problems as they become adults. So why don't we kind of close off with your comments and thoughts about play, and it's important both for children, and I think it's important for adults, especially as parents, to be able to have time to play as well. I'd like to hear from each one of you on how you think about play.
Well, we were very big into play.
Not were, are.
Yes, are. Dave makes animal sounds over Skype to the grandchildren, and they make animal growlings back at him. They have a great time. It is going intergenerational. So valuable, so fun, and those are building those bonds of friendship and support, really building the shelter of family, too. And they do learn a lot from fighting with each other, and I love play. Can't get enough of it. I think I just got this great picture book called Octopus Hug by Lawrence Pringle, and it's the dad doing these roughhouse kind of games with the kids. It's just marvelous, especially for dads that may not have had that model of how to do it. But I thought it's so beautifully shown in this picture book how the dad is using his strength to protect the kids, but also to let them test themselves against him. You know, he holds them down, but he always lets them get away. And so it's wonderful.
As a biologist, part of my training, I've always believed, well, from a very early age, I've believed that as mammals, we are hardwired to play. I mean, we're humans, so we have that higher cognitive aspect of play, but I think we need play to stay relatively sane. I don't know anybody who's completely sane. But I think if you take away play, there's going to be serious consequences. Again, in my work with education, we're looking at making games a bigger part of learning because, hey, it works. It engages learners at all ages.
We like board games, too.
We've always played games with our children, and it's probably going to come back and bite us at some point.
Well, they all still play games with their friends.
Yeah, I really liked the comment of not intervening, you know, when things are getting a little rough and tough or when they're having their little negotiations that can feel very dramatic. And a lot of times we want to step in and protect our children from those types of interactions. And at the same time, you know, there's always that other side of the coin where I do think it's important to protect, especially younger siblings from older, if it's physical. There is definitely that parental structure of allowing for, you know, rules to be there for protection, because kids can be bullies and kids can, you know, act inappropriately when it comes to some of those dynamics between themselves. So again, that's a balancing act that, like most things in parenting, we're supposed to figure out, which adds to this ongoing stress that we feel to get things right. I was going to also mention that I think another big thing that play offers children is healing from trauma. It's interesting that when we see, for example, here in Kansas not too long ago, we had this really horrible tornado that came through Joplin and then not a year later through Oklahoma City. And so there was a lot of concern of supportive families and communities during that time. And what were the kids doing? They were out there playing tornado. You're playing tornado. And that's really significant for us to allow them to, you know, play through their fears and their anxieties. And in fact, talk therapy is not useful for children. There's a very great, wonderful movement of play therapy that is being adopted by a lot of family and other types of mental health professionals, that where really the kids come in and it's through play and through sandboxes and through all different types of strategies that they can get the kids to really work through whatever traumatic experiences are happening in their lives, because you're just not going to be very successful with a 7-year-old sitting down and going, well, tell me how you feel about this. You know, it's not their language yet. Their real language is play. And then I'll put in a plug for the sex therapy piece of me. You know, again, I think we do this. There's lots of ways that adults can play together, but I think sexuality is a big one. And I think that sometimes we do a disservice to sexuality by either villainizing it or sanctifying it. And although I think that there's truth in both of those, it is sacred and it can be used for really evil purposes. There's a playfulness and a kind of an animalistic or fun playfulness towards sexuality that is not about it being holy and sacred, and it's not about having kiddos, that we can really learn how to engage in as partners, that can be a huge stress relief and a huge bonding glue during these very turbulent times of parenthood. So just a shout out for sex. And
amen.
We are totally with you on that. Kept us together for a long, long time.
Right. And that, and for those that that might not be working out, I mean, not to shame you, but like, get help for that, or find a way to talk about that with somebody who you might, you know, it's lots of people have sexual problems and issues and don't know how to play together. We don't have a lot of great role models to teach you how to do that. So don't shame yourselves about it. Just say, okay, maybe this is an area where we need to look into it.
Yeah, I think I'm really glad you mentioned that, and the therapeutic part of play, both for children and I think for adults as well, where just raising kids is stressful, and we have different things that come up, and in online Mormonism we have a whole lot of the faith transitions that for most I would say is very, very traumatic. And I remember some advice my dad gave me at one point was to go and watch Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? You know, watch some of our favorite funny movies. And it takes you to this place where you're not really watching the clock, where you're just feeling good. And I think sex and other ways that we play, you know, maybe in a family you have a tradition of card games or something like that, where you can go to that place and your mind sort of empties itself and you can get a little bit of a rest from whatever is stressing you at the time. So I think that's a really good way to look at play for us as adults, and to allow our kids the same thing as they're learning and developing, and they're getting breaks from whatever's stressing them as well.
Absolutely.
Does anyone else have any other closing thoughts?
One of our family rituals, we would play different kinds of word games and different games to get chores done at times. One of the things we did when you talk about chilling out, we used to watch Star Trek every Sunday night. And some people were, you're breaking the Sabbath. How do you, why are you doing that? But what we found is there were often lessons we could talk about with our children. And I didn't realize what a big deal this was until we were visiting my dad in California. At the time we lived in Utah, we were at the Huntington Museum, and we had divided up. I was with my dad, and Vilo had the three kids at the time. And our oldest daughter, who wasn't very old at the time, came running to find my dad and me in the art gallery and said, "You got to come out. You got to come out. I found something really neat." So we came out, and what they had found that was really neat was a stone bench with a plaque dedicated to Gene Roddenberry that had been paid for by Leonard Nimoy. And they regarded it, my daughter's like, "It's like a shrine for Star Trek. Should we have a prayer?"
And did you?
Kind of did have a little gathering ritual.
At least a moment of silence.
And the kids are all really into this, and my dad is like, "What is wrong with your family?"
Oh, that's a great story. We can't cut that out. Every Sunday for me growing up, we would watch nature, and we would watch lions and hyenas eat each other. And I have a fond feeling for African battles on the Serengeti because of that.
Well, I think that some of my closing statements would be that I think the journey of parenthood is one where we will inadvertently be helpful to our kids, and we will, without doubt, be harmful to our kids. I don't think anybody can escape either one of those predicaments. And I really liked what Jennifer Senior said, you know, in her TED Talk about, you know, when she held her baby for the first time and just kind of, you know, had this moment of awareness with her child and just, you know, whispering into his ear that I will try and not hurt you. You know, kind of like the Hippocratic Oath, you know, that I will try to do no harm, but also being aware that she will do harm to that child in some way or another, because we are all imperfect creatures and we all learn through the process of parenting and we all make mistakes. So I really appreciate, for example, the scriptural story of Lehi and Soraya, and they have all these kiddos, and same parents, same DNA, some go this way, some go that way, right? And that, I think, happens in many families. And there are issues that we probably could have done better on. And if there's forgiveness to be asked for, let's own that and ask it. But I think we also need to be forgiving of ourselves, and we also need to understand that there's a lot out of our control. And at the end of the day, can you be a safe space in general for these people to come back and relate things to you? I think that that would be a great goal for all of us to have.
Yes, I think two understandings. One is that we were sent to this earth with weaknesses. The Lord knew that we had those. And some of our weaknesses can become strength, not only for us, but for our children. Sometimes that's where their resilience comes in, is the things that they had to do because of our weaknesses that they were able to overcome it. And not something we should beat ourselves up about. We repent and move on.
All right. This has been really great. I think we've had a great conversation. I think a lot of the listeners will gain a lot from it. I know I have. Thank you so much for coming on, and I guess we'll see you on the flip side.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. Reach out.